All right. So we left off last week talking about, if you have the handout, question four, the covenant that Jonathan made with David because of the love that was shared by the two of them. The phrase the Bible uses is that their souls were knit together. And so it's speaking of an extremely close friendship and relationship. And we talked about the covenant that they made together and kind of how that came about was Jonathan took off all of his royal military garb, his armor, his sword, and all of that, gave it to David. And talked a little bit about exactly the reasoning behind that. And the, you know, scholars aren't 100% sure. I kind of tend to think that this was the covenant that was made between their relationship that would sustain their protection upon their extended family, such as under the assumption that when David took the throne that David would preserve the family, the children of Jonathan. And from my understanding, I kind of saw it like that. But there are some who also think, scholarly as well, that this was simply a friendship that was budding, and the result of that further covenant where David is revealed to be God's chosen king comes later. So you can look at that however you want. We're not told explicitly here exactly what it was, but they did make a covenant. There's this deep bonding that's taking place between David and Jonathan. And so we're picking up here kind of in the middle of the story as Jonathan's kind of going to drop off the scene a little bit, a second interlude. And as I said, this is a story revolving around David. You know, he's the one that is recorded here. Much of the detail, though, about Jonathan's life, we kind of pick up on the periphery. So if you wonder, well, why do we keep talking about David and Saul? Well, it's because Jonathan kind of fits into their story rather than they fitting into his. And so for us to understand Jonathan's life as it kind of goes along, we've just got to lay down some things because this is David's story while Jonathan is inserted into it. So something of an interlude after this covenant is made, David is going to prosper and Saul's hatred for David is going to grow. Now you may find that ironic because just previously we read that after the defeat of Goliath, Saul takes David, makes him his armor bearer, and it says that Saul loved David very much. However, we know Saul was a jealous man, and after seeing David's success, after hearing the songs the women of Israel sang, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s, well, Saul's love for David quickly turns to pride, to anger, and to hatred. And so we have this prosperity of David and this decrease of Saul. If you're there in 1 Samuel 18, let's read a few verses, starting in verse 5, and it can probably say it better than I could tell it, and kind of just lay this foundation here. So, 1 Samuel 18, starting in verse 5. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered, and Saul set him over men of war, and it was pleasing in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. And it happened as they were coming when David returned from killing the Philistine, and the women came out of the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And then Saul became very angry, for this saying displeased him. And he said, they ascribe to David 10,000s, but to me they ascribe thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? So Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. Verse 10, now it came about on the next day that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon the house, upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house while David was playing the harp with his hand as usual, and a spear was in Saul's hand. So it's at this point that the murder begins to grow within Saul's heart. A little bit later on, he's going to make an attempt on David's life in verse 11. You know, and this is, remember, the Spirit of the Lord had left Saul, and God sent an evil spirit to terrorize him. David was brought in to kind of soothe him with the musical instruments. And as he's there, and Saul is in one of these fits, this terrorizing from the evil spirit, he has in his hand a spear and says, well, I'm going to just take care of this David problem right now, and tries to kill him. And so murder begins to show in David's, in Saul's heart toward David. A little bit later on, obviously the spear attempt is going to fail. Under the pretense of marrying Saul's daughter, he says, David, you can marry my daughter Michal if you bring me back 100 Philistine foreskins. Thinking that David's going to go after this prize to marry the king's daughter, and that in the process David will be killed at the hands of the Philistines, he gives him the seemingly impossible task. Well, David brings back 200 because the Spirit of the Lord has left Saul and has come upon David. And so David kills 200 and takes Michal to be his wife. Look down in verse 28. when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, then Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus Saul was David's enemy continually. Kind of an interesting turn of events there. Okay, one, keep in mind, Saul knows that David has the Lord's favor and that he does not. So everything in the future that Saul does, he does with the knowledge that God is no longer with him, but he is with David. All of the attempts on David's life he is making against the Lord's chosen one. And kind of something interesting there, you know, we think that oftentimes if somebody treats us as an enemy, well, we're going to view them in that same view. But the text here clearly tells us that Saul was David's enemy continually. And you can examine that relationship and you can see that while Saul chose to make an enemy of David, David never condescended to make an enemy of Saul. You know, he always treated him with the same love and care and respect, and he honored his position. And so this was kind of a one-sided hatred deal. Okay, but that's what we see from Saul there. Look at verse 1 of chapter 19. Saul told Jonathan his son and all the servants to put David to death. But Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. So it seems at this point that Saul's not aware of the close friendship between Jonathan and David. Or if he doesn't realize it, he thinks that Jonathan possesses the same characteristics that he does. Ambition, pride, a desire for the throne. And he thinks, well, this is greater than his love for David. So if I tell Jonathan and the soldiers to bring David to me, or kill David and bring him to me, well, Jonathan's desire for the throne is going to override his love and his care for David. However, instead of trying to kill him, Jonathan warns David what Saul is trying to do, and he sends him into hiding until he can talk his father out of killing David. So he meets with Saul, David's in hiding, and he reminds Saul of all the things that David has done and how he's essentially saved the nation. And so Saul listens and he swears by the name of God that David's not going to be put to death. And so Jonathan brings David back into his father's presence. Unsurprisingly, Saul's not true to his word. He tries to kill David again. And after making multiple attempts on David's life, he's forced to flee, unsurprisingly. So in chapter 20, David goes to Ramah seeking Jonathan out, wanting to know, why is your father so intent on taking my life? And Jonathan tells David, don't worry, my dad's not going to do anything without first telling me. And now what Jonathan doesn't realize is at this point in time, his father is on to the friendship that Jonathan and David has. And so he's acting independent of Jonathan. He's not telling Jonathan of his plans for David because it seems he doesn't want Jonathan to be aggrieved whenever David's life is taken. And so Jonathan says to David, what would you have me do to put your mind at ease? Okay, and that's going to bring us to question 5. But how did Jonathan test Saul to measure his feelings toward David? Okay, and I don't remember where we left off. It's kind of been... Okay. Buster?
I put down with this series of questions. He says, why should it be slain? What has he done?
That's, okay.
I didn't know if that's what you wanted or not.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. You know, he questions him and reminds Saul of what David has done. Okay, and so it sets it up as a pretty extravagant deal to gauge the king's feelings toward David. It seems like Saul's got this monthly feast with his generals, with his men of war, with all of his officials. And so it's a 3-day thing. And so Jonathan, or rather David, says, I'm going to be absent from the next feast. And what I want you to do is, when I'm absent from that feast, you tell Saul, well, David went to offer this yearly sacrifice with his family. And if Saul's like, okay, that's cool, that's fine, whatever, then we'll know that I'm back in his favor and that I'm safe. But if he gets angry that you've let me go offer the sacrifice, then we will know that he intends harm for me. So the festival arrives, or the feasting arrives, and Saul's commanders gather to eat. And it's a 3-day feast. Remember, first day David's not there. So Saul thinks to himself, oh, it's just coincidence. David's unclean. And by purity law, he would have 1 day to purify himself. And then he would be able to come to the feast and re-engage there. So second day shows up, no David there. And so now Saul's suspicious. And it's this point in time that he turns to Jonathan and says, where is David? Why hasn't the son of Jesse been here to eat with us? And so Jonathan gives his father the concocted excuse about David going home to offer a sacrifice with his family. And some commentators believe that this was simply a lie that David concocted to test Saul's view of him. Others believe, and I think probably in an attempt to preserve David's integrity, that David actually did go back to Bethlehem, so that this was a true statement, or rather this was his intention all along. I have a tendency to believe he just kind of pulled it out of thin air to test the king, but, you know, that's neither here nor there. We're not told. That's not really the point. So whenever Jonathan says, well, David's going back to Bethlehem to offer these sacrifices with his family, Saul gets angry. And listen to what he does in verse 31 of 1 Samuel 20:31. He says to Jonathan, for as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore now send and bring him to me, for he must surely die. So Saul can see God's favor upon David, and he knows that God's chosen him to be king. Somewhere in his deranged mind, remember, Saul knows that the favor of the Lord has left him and is on David. But somewhere in his deranged mind, Saul thinks that he's going to be able to foil the plan of God to keep David from the throne that God is intent on giving him and keep the throne in his family. Now, we know that Jonathan doesn't care as much about the throne as Saul does. In fact, he's happy to give it away. And rather than latching on this idea to secure his place as crown prince, as Buster said, Jonathan again tries to convince Saul of David's innocence. And it's at this point that Saul realizes that Jonathan and David are in cahoots together, and he becomes angry and directs that rage at Jonathan. Okay, and that brings us to question 6. Saul's anger at Jonathan's protection of David was so great that he threw a what?
Spear.
All of the anger that Saul had at David in that moment was transferred to his son, Jonathan. And as he's talking about trying to preserve the throne for him, and just a moment later, he takes and tries to skewer his son to the wall with this spear. Now, we might pause a minute and make a point here about the power that volcanic anger has. There's a New Testament term that Paul oftentimes uses as he talks about various sins that people can be guilty of, and it's outbursts of wrath. And I think here you see in this example the power that the outburst of wrath, volcanic anger, has. Because you've got Saul on one hand who is trying to preserve the throne for his son, and then just a moment later, he's trying to kill the very son that he is trying to preserve the throne for. You may argue, well, he wasn't really trying to kill Jonathan or whatever the case was. We'll read that a little bit more in just a moment. But surely Saul would not have wanted Jonathan dead. But in that moment, that's how angry he was. And that's why the Bible tells us that when we're angry, we need to push the pause button. We need to slow down, let the anger pass before we act. Or you might do something ignorant like Saul has done. And we've probably all seen instances in our life where we've acted in anger and said or done things that we greatly regretted. Tommy?
Yeah, we see even today. Say someone has two mutual friends that are fighting, you know, not physically, but not getting along, and you go and try to mediate and, you know, try to find out what's going on and have to find middle ground, but one of them will end up getting mad at you because they think you're taking the other one's side.
Right. And, you know, that that's David. Jonathan's trying to mediate between David and Saul, right? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when you... There's a proverb, too, that says something to the effect that don't stick your hand in a situation like that, or you may find yourself in trouble. But yet Jonathan, as we're going to see, he's trying to mediate in between his father and David. And, you know, Saul's anger in that moment is transferred at Jonathan. And you got to be careful and handle situations like that delicately. Otherwise, you can get yourself in a great deal of trouble. So we see there the power of volcanic anger. Now, stop and think about this for a moment. Who is Jonathan loyal to? Who is Jonathan loyal to? Now, my first thought is to think, well, his loyalty is to David. And we're repeatedly told that Jonathan loved David as he loved his own soul. And that much is honest, is obvious. But I think there's that more deeply that Jonathan's loyalty isn't to David directly, but rather his loyalty is to God. That's kind of who I see his loyalty to. I see a couple nodding heads out there, so I think we're on the same frame of reference here. Jonathan's loyalty seems to be toward God. He's shown himself to be a man of confidence and faith in God because of his battle and his excursions with the Philistines. And I would suggest to you that had God allowed Jonathan to take the throne and to sit on it and reign after Saul, that there would have sat on the throne a man after God's own heart. However, God in his wisdom chose not to allow that to happen, but searched out for himself someone, David, the one that he wanted to fulfill the greater purpose of Scripture, as we know that David's going to be instrumental in building Israel up and particularly in bringing about the Messiah, the promise that God would make to him. That plan wasn't for Jonathan, that plan was for David. And so all of these things have to happen. However, you know, while the love for his friend David was there, it was the love of God that really, I think, united the two of them together. And Jonathan's nobody's fool. At this point in time, Saul's tried to get him multiple occasions. Bring David to me. We'll take care of him. We'll secure the throne for you. Jonathan has no ambition for the throne. And I believe Jonathan has no ambition for the throne because he realizes that the throne is not in his future. Because I think somehow that's been either revealed to him by David or by God or by the obvious that God's spirit has departed from Saul and is now on David. And so he can see the favor of the Lord on David. And listen to the covenant that they make that reaffirms their friendship. In verses 14 and 15, kind of back up a little bit. 14 and 15, because I believe this is really telling here about Jonathan's understanding of David taking the throne. 1 Samuel 20:14-15, Jonathan says to David, and this is the renewal of the covenant, or the making of the covenant, however you want to see that. He says, If I am still alive, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord, that I may not die? You shall not cut off the loving kindness from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. Okay, so Jonathan sees the writing on the wall. He sees that the Lord is with David. And the only way for David to sit on the throne is to remove the previous king. Not just the previous king, but also his entire lineage. And so Jonathan recognizes Saul as David's enemy, and Saul is standing between David and the throne, and Saul's going to have to be eliminated along with all of his family. And so this is the covenant that they make. And he says, whenever the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David, that is, whenever God removes the family of Saul, being Saul's son, Jonathan would obviously have to be killed, have to be removed because of the fact that he could serve as a barrier and a dividing factor among the country. And so he enters into this covenant with David and says, when God wipes your enemies off the face of the earth, please spare me. Okay, he's asking for his life because he recognizes that the Lord is with David and that God is going to remove the house of Saul. And so he says, if I'm still alive, spare me. And then he asks for the loving kindness of David, not to cut off his house forever. And so we know that actually happens. And so this covenant's a very important deal because when David takes the throne, although Jonathan is going to be dead, Jonathan is going to have a son by the name of Mephibosheth. And ordinarily, you know, the king, a new king in a takeover, would eliminate all of the family. And so Mephibosheth, under ordinary circumstances, would have been put to death, with the exception of the fact that this covenant was made between Jonathan and David not to cut off Jonathan's line from the earth. And so this is the reason for the covenant. And he asked for, he says, if I'm not alive, then have mercy on my children. Have mercy on my family. Don't wipe them out whenever you take the throne and whenever the Lord removes your enemies from the face of the earth. So that's the reason of the covenant. And I think we can clearly see something in Jonathan here that is a loyalty to David, but a deeper loyalty to God. And let me suggest, tie in something here, a little lesson for us. This is the loyalty that God requires of us as Christians. That is not a loyalty first and foremost to family, but a loyalty first and foremost to God. Because oftentimes the biggest hindrance, the biggest stumbling block for our loyalty to the Lord is our loyalty to our family. In Luke 14:33, Jesus says, if anyone comes to me, does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And that's why I think it was important for us to understand, I don't think Jonathan's ultimate loyalty is to David, but I think it's to God. But because his loyalty is to God, he's going to be loyal to David because he understands that David stands at the heart of all that God is doing. And rather than being loyal to his father, his loyalty is first and foremost to God. And we see in verse 30 where Saul is in this violent rage, and rather than siding with his father, Jonathan defends the one God has chosen. And we Christians would do well to take a page out of Jonathan's book when it comes to that kind of loyalty. You ever heard someone say, maybe a family member or maybe another Christian, this phrase that blood is thicker than water? And the idea behind that is, you know, family relationships, that is, as blood, have to come before Christian relationships because, you know, we're united with Christ in baptism. And so, you know, the phrase is sometimes used, blood is thicker than water. And frankly, when you look at what Scripture has to say about our relationship with our brethren, that is completely false. I know family is important, and I don't deny, neither would the Bible deny, the closeness and the love that family must have for one another. But we have to also understand our loyalty first and foremost, as we see with Jonathan, does not reside to our physical blood relatives, but it is to be first and foremost to God's people. Ideally, you know, that which is blood we're also related to through Christ. But at the same time, that isn't often the case. And there are very likely going to be times in our life where we have to choose family over faith. And a lot of people, a lot of Christians, and I've seen it made a lot of times, where rather than choosing one's faith over one's family, the reverse is true. They will side with their family, oh, and they will compromise their faith. I've seen it happen where loved ones are living in blatant sin, and maybe the church withdraws from someone after having gone to them and trying to get them to repent. They refuse to repent. The church withdraws from them. And I've often seen individual members of a congregation refuse to accept the church's decision, and rather than standing with God's people, standing with their family when their family members are in the wrong. And I can't imagine, I just can't imagine how hard that must be. But we see here in Jonathan a good example of the need to stand with God and with God's people if we find them intersecting with family. Jonathan's loyalty was to the man God had chosen, and in doing so, he was loyal to God. And I think we also see kind of a Jesus-type love here in Jonathan as well. What did Jesus say was the greatest sign of love?
Lay down your life, my brother.
Okay. Greater love has no man than this, than to lay down his life for a friend. And obviously Jesus is speaking about the apostles who he says, you are my friends if you keep my word. But Jesus was talking about the sacrifice he was getting ready to make. And we can all understand how that kind of sacrifice is the greatest love that anyone can have. And Jonathan might very well have kept quiet and just kind of said, well, I'm going to just let events take their course. And if my father kills David, well, so be it. But I want you to notice that it angered Jonathan. What angered Jonathan perhaps the most about this whole situation? And look at verse 34. I find this kind of interesting here. Chapter 20 and verse 34. Then Jonathan arose, and this is after Saul tried to kill him with the spear. Then Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger, did not eat food on the second day of the new moon, for he was grieved over David, because his father had dishonored him. I tell you, that's really selfless love, isn't it? You think about Jonathan. I don't know about you, but I feel like if I were Jonathan, my anger would be about the fact that my father had just tried to kill me. That's what I would probably be angry about. But yet, Jonathan kind of straight shakes that off, and his anger is the fact that his father has dishonored David. Okay, that's a Jesus kind of love, where Jonathan could have just stepped out of the way and said, you know, I'm going to let things unfold. But no, he stepped up. He stood for the truth. Like Buster said, he tried to convince his father, this is not the way to go. This is not God's plan. He took a stand, even though it put him right in his father's crosshairs. And he was willing to lay it all down for David, but also for the Lord as well. So Jonathan goes and he communicates to David that his father's intentions are to have him killed. Anyone want to comment on anything we've talked about? We've kind of covered a lot of ground this morning. Anyone want to weigh in? All right, let's push the story along. Question 7, how did Jonathan then signal to David that his father intended him harm?
His instructions to the little boy about retrieving the arrow.
Okay, so remember back in chapter 20, they made this deal. David says, this is what you're going to tell your father. And this is, Jonathan said, this is how it's going to be communicated. Okay, they're acting very covertly because they don't know if maybe Saul may intervene, may prohibit Jonathan from going to David. And so they've got this very covert signal to communicate to David whether his life is in danger or whether he's safe and been restored to Saul's favor. So he says, I'm going to go out to the field and I'm going to shoot. And if the arrows I'm shooting, you're hiding in the field, if they fall shy of you, then that's a signal that my father is once again accepted you back into his favor. If they go beyond you, then that's a signal that he seeks to do you harm. So he pulls the little boy, or rather he has the little boy, he shoots the arrow, the boy goes beyond David, communicates to David that he's out of Saul's favor, Saul seeks his life, and so David gets the message, Jonathan sends the little boy back with the bow and the arrows to the city, and David comes out and bids Jonathan a very tearful farewell. One more observation, kind of a small detail here before we depart this particular story. Look back at verse 22. All right, yeah, verse 22 of chapter 20. Okay, in the signal that David and Jonathan are setting up. Listen to how David, Jonathan communicates this. He says, "But if I say to the youth, 'Behold, the arrows are beyond you, go, for the Lord has sent you away.'" Now, I know that's a very small statement, and we may say that as kind of insignificant, but I want you to understand Jonathan's perspective on life. And I think, Christians, and maybe it's just me, maybe you would disagree with me, I think sometimes we don't give God enough credit. I understand that God isn't involved in absolutely every single thing, and I know the Calvinistic idea of sovereignty, that every single thing that happens, meaningful, insignificant, is preordained by the hand of God. That's their view of God's sovereignty. I don't share that view of God's sovereignty. But I also think that we don't oftentimes give God enough credit for the way that He works in our life. Jonathan's perspective is very God-centered. And I try to reflect this in my own life. For my perspective to be very God-centered. And he says here, you don't go and you run. Rather, he says that if indeed my father's still angry at you, then this will be the signal that God is sending you away. Okay, he could have took it upon himself. He could have took it upon David. But he recognizes that superintending all of these things is ultimately God. And it's God's plan. And so he says, if this turns out to be the case, then understand what's happening. It's the Lord that's sending you away. And I just like Jonathan's God-centered perspective. And you and I might say about that, well, if Saul's angry, you need to get away. But Jonathan says, no, if this happens and Saul's angry, then understand that it's the Lord who's sending you away. And it's kind of just a small detail there, but I very much appreciate how God-centered and that Jonathan is in his mentality and his thinking. So, interlude number three, Saul's pursuit for David continues. So, for the next several years, Saul's going to catch David's life. Whitney?
I have a question. Why do you
Why do I think Jonathan didn't go with David?
I do.
And I think probably you nailed it there. One thing we know about Jonathan, first and foremost, and I thought about this. Jonathan, his number one trait seems to be loyalty. And he's loyal, first and foremost, to God. But I think that loyalty isn't just to God, but I think he's also got loyalty to his father. And I think there's a number of reasons why Jonathan doesn't go with David. If I'm Jonathan, I'm probably thinking the best way that I can protect David is to be a mole, to stay close to my father, to try. And perhaps Jonathan, I think Jonathan probably even wants to try to bring his father around as he's done before. You know, it's like a family member that's lost, living in sin. You never give up on him. You never give up on them. You do whatever you can to constantly try to be a presence to remind them that they need to do what's right. And I think that Jonathan figures the best way he can protect David is by staying close to his father. And maybe even he can one day bring Saul around. I don't think we're not explicitly told in Scripture. That's just kind of my take on that. David?
I have two observations. For one, to me, the field would have to be pretty low cut with the sea and arrow sticking up. And two, Jonathan had to be fairly close to David for him to gain enough archery there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's that was probably part of it, and I didn't look in that detail. I know we're digging into a lot of the details. I didn't look into that detail to try to figure out what may have been planted and what season it might have been. But you're right, David would have had to know, or at the very least, you know, maybe he was at the edge of the field and he shot it at the edge of the field, and David's kind of laying out there, and he can hear the little boy run past him or something like that. You know, there's a number of ways that could play out. But good points, Tommy.
Message wasn't in where the arrow landed. Message. When Jonathan told the boy, it's beyond you, it's inside of you, David would have heard his voice.
Okay.
You know, like David would say it here, it'd be hard to see where the arrow landed.
Yeah.
The message was like,
okay, so as you're saying, yeah, I think you're right. It was the phrase that he told, you know, was if it goes beyond you, then that was the signal. And David, while he may not have seen the arrow, would have heard Jonathan's voice. Good observation catching it, Tommy. Dave?
You still have responsibilities in court. I think it's part of what all of that is in his makeup, part of Jonathan's family. I think it's some of what you said, and I think it's some of his because of responsibilities in court. He's not going to shirk the responsibility.
Good point. You know, as and for those who are listening at home, has some good comments there. The last one that Dave brought out is as to why Jonathan might not have left with David. It's just kind of part of who he was, it seems. And if he thinks, you think about the responsibilities that Jonathan would have had as the crown prince, then he just wasn't one to shirk responsibility. He was loyal. He had initiative. And it's just part of who he was to be loyal. And, you know, you combine that with his understanding of the big picture as well as his desire to protect David. He just it seemed to think that the best thing he could do was to stay with his father. So we'll pick up with this third interlude, and we will get through question 10, and I've got an interesting observation at the end, and we may be able to break into our discussion questions next week. So just real good participation in our class this morning. Thank you for your attention and the sharing and your questions and all of those things.